Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the time and date duly noticed for a hearing in docket number 1303-5184. It's Rocky Mountain Power's general rate case proceeding. The formal caption is in the matter of the application of Rocky Mountain Power for authority to increase its retail electric utility service rates in Utah and for approval of its proposed electric service schedules and electric service regulations. I'm Commissioner David Clark. To my left is Commission Chairman Ron Allen, and to his left is Commissioner Thad LaVar. And we'll begin this morning by taking the appearances of counsel. And if you would also introduce witnesses that you have present to testify today, that would be helpful. And we'll begin with the applicant, Mr. Monson.
Gregory Monson, Stoll Reeves, appearing for Rocky Mountain Power. And with me today are Bruce Williams and Dr. Samuel Hathaway, who are our two witnesses.
Thank you.
Patricia E. Schmid and Justin C. Jetter with the Utah Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Division of Public Utilities. The witness today is Mr. Charles E. Peterson.
Brent Coleman with the Utah Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Office of Consumer Services. And with me at the council table is Mr. Dan Lawton, who will be sponsoring the office's testimony today.
Thank you.
Captain Thomas Jernigan with the Federal Executive Agencies, and I'm here with Mr. Mike Gorman.
Gary Dodge on behalf of UAE. UAE does not have a witness in this phase of the proceeding, so I will primarily be an observer.
Any other appearances? I know that we have at least one person on the phone. If any on the phone intend to participate in any way in the proceeding, we would appreciate it if you would identify yourselves now by providing your name and the organization or client with whom you're associated.
Yes, thank you. Hi, this is Misha Gross from Greenberg Ferrari on behalf of Walmart.
Thank you very much. Are there any preliminary matters before I describe the process that we propose for our hearing today? There appear to be none. What we would intend to do today is to begin the presentation of evidence with the applicant, followed by the division and the office and then the federal executive agencies. And when we have the cross-examination of witnesses, we'll have the applicant go last as it if it desires to cross-examine witnesses of the other parties, at least if that's what you would like to do, Mr. Monson.
That's fine.
Okay. Anything else that we should settle before we proceed? Mr. Monson, please proceed.
We'll call Bruce Williams as our first witness.
All right. Before you're seated, Mr. Williams, if you'd raise your right hand, please. You solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Mr. Williams, could you please state your full name for the record?
My name is Bruce Williams.
And what? By whom are you employed?
I am employed by PacifiCorp or Rocky Mountain Power.
In what capacity?
I am the Vice President and Treasurer.
And what's your business address?
825 Northeast Multnomah, Portland, Oregon, 97232.
Thank you. Did you prepare direct testimony in this proceeding, which includes exhibits 1 through 14?
Yes, I did.
And do you have any corrections that you wish to make to that testimony?
No, I do not.
And did you also prepare and file a rebuttal testimony, which includes exhibits 1R through 5R?
Yes, I did.
Do you have any corrections you wish to make to that testimony?
No, there are no corrections to that testimony either.
So if I were to ask you the questions set forth in your direct and rebuttal testimony today, your answers would be the same as set forth therein?
Yes, they would be the same.
Okay. And do you have a summary of your testimony?
I have a brief summary.
Could you please present that?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and discuss the cost of capital in this case. My testimony concerns capital structure and the cost of debt and preferred. Dr. Hadaway will talk about cost of equity and the other witnesses as well. The capital structure is relatively non-controversial in this. The company has proposed using the actual capital structure and actual cost of debt and preferred, which I think has generally been accepted by all the parties in this case. But just to highlight, the common equity component of the capital structure is 51.43%. That's a decrease from the last order for the company here in Utah. And we hope to continue lower that common equity component, much as Mr. Peterson suggests, but that will depend on financial ratios and results in rate cases here and other states as well. The cost of debt has also declined dramatically over the last 4 or 5 years. As recently as 2010, the cost of debt was about 6%. In this case today, we're proposing 5.20. So we've lowered the cost of debt approximately 80 basis points in 4 years or so. And that's been possible partially or primarily through the company maintaining its ratings, which has allowed it to access the markets on favorable terms and rates. And we think that's important because all those cost savings are passed directly to customers in terms of the revenue requirements. And I think in my direct testimony, we estimated the reduction from the 6% to the 5.24 it was in the direct testimony. That's about, I think it was $20 million revenue requirement savings for customers in this case. So it does have a valuable impact on the customers here. Finally, you'll hear a lot about ROEs, I'm sure, later this morning, this afternoon. The point I want to make is that the ROEs do have an impact on financial ratios and can impact ratings, both quantitatively, and I'm sure there'll be some discussion about that. And those ratios are an important consideration by the rating agencies as they provide their ratings on the company. And lower ratings will result in higher debt costs and higher cost to customers. The other impact of the ROEs is also qualitative, and I think it's an important signal that the rating agencies look at as to how credit supportive commissions and other bodies are as to the utility. So I would say it's both a combination of the quantitative, the models, and the results that come out of those, but also qualitative, especially if an ROE is significantly out of line with averages in other parts of the country. So that's it for my summary.
Thank you. So we would offer Mr. Williams' direct and rebuttal testimony with their accompanying exhibits.
Any objections?
None.
Nothing from the office.
No objections.
They're received in evidence.
Thank you. Mr. Williams is available for cross-examination.
Ms. Schmidt.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
My questions relate to credit and credit ratings. As Vice President and Treasurer, you're responsible for the company's risk management and capital structure testimony and rate case filings. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. And the testimony, yes. There are, others who are obviously involved in setting capital structure. But in terms of testimony, yes, I'm the primary witness.
Are you familiar with the things that they use in setting capital structure? Does your knowledge extend that far?
They being the company when we're
yes.
Yes, I'm very familiar with that. I'm one of the people that's heavily involved, but I didn't want to mislead you to think I'm the sole person that does that.
Thank you. Do rating agencies such as Fitch, Moody's, Standard & Poor's look at existing in rate and regulatory treatment by state regulatory agencies?
Yes.
When these credit agencies are looking at companies and assigning ratings. Do you know if they look at return on equity, among other things?
Yes, they will look at return on equity, authorized as well as earned. There are a number of criteria that go into the ratings. That is certainly one of them, but there are many others as well.
When a company such as Moody's is assigning a rating to a company, do they also look at the company's capital structure?
Yes, that's certainly one of their components.
And in combination with the capital structure, does Moody's assign a value or a rating based on the company's... Okay, let me start again. When Moody assigns a rating to a company and is looking at the company's capital structure, is there a range at which capital structures fit into to get a particular rating? For like a capital structure of 45% to 55% equity would get an A, for example, just hypothetically,
right.
And something else would get a B, or is it a point thing?
I'm going to answer your question maybe a little bit differently. If this isn't sufficient, please ask follow-up. But it's not quite that simple. They look at capital structure. They look at other measures. They also look at the financial results and ratios that are produced by that capital structure and by the financial decisions that the company makes. They will also look at other kind of quantitative and qualitative measures as well. You know, diversity, fuel source, things like that. So it's not quite as simple as your capital structure directly drives the ratings. It's certainly an important determinant, but there are other things as well. But it's, you know, to the extent the capital structure then influences the resulting financial ratios and credit metrics, you know, yes, but it's not quite that exact of a science.
And you may have answered this question generally, but I'd like a specific answer, please. Have any of the rating agencies told you that Pacific Core would be downgraded if its equity percentage dropped below 50%?
I think if you read some of the S&P reports and Moody's as well, there's usually a section about what could lead to ratings changes up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And typically in the downgrade, they will talk about downgrade scenario, what could lead to that. They'll talk about excess leverage or an increase in leverage, things like that, that would kind of correspond to a decrease in the equity component. But to be clear, they haven't said if you go to 50.1, we're going to downgrade you. It doesn't quite work that way. It's more, again, the quantitative assessments. But certainly, you know, the more leverage, the greater the chance for a downgrade.
So... in conjunction with your role at Pacific Core, dealing with credit agencies, ratings, and the like, do you know if Pacific Core prepares or uses things like a business plan or other like documents?
Oh, yes. We have a very extensive business planning process and a very detailed business plan.
And these are for internal review?
They're also shared with the parent company, Berkshire Hathaway Energy, and I presume Berkshire Hathaway as well, and then portions of it, not the full 10 years, but typically the first 5 years are presented to the rating agencies.
In these business reports, is there often a section on credit agency ratings?
Yes.
You said that return on equity is one of the things that is examined when a rating agency is looking at assigning a rating to a company. And I know that Dr. Hathaway is the company's ROE witness, but I have some questions relating to internal company functions associated with ROE, so I'm going to ask you those.
Okay, I'll try to answer the best I can.
Do you know if the business plans that we've previously referenced sometimes contain estimates, forecasts, or projections of what ROE will be awarded in rate cases?
I believe that's a component of that, yes.
Did you see a business plan or similar document that discussed the ROE that might be awarded in this case?
I have seen the plan. I cannot recall what the ROE that the plan assumed would be awarded in this case is. I would expect it's probably in the line of 9.8 to 10%, kind of consistent where the ROE is today. But I can't tell you with certainty what was in the plan for the ROE in this case.
And do the plans generally just look at, for example, this rate case, or do they go and project into the next rate case too?
The plan is a 10-year plan, so it'll, depending on what the company anticipates for rate cases, it'll have, you know, as many rate cases as the company expects to file during that 10-year period.
Thank you. Those are all my questions. Okay.
Mr. Coleman.
I have no questions for Mr. Williams.
Captain Jernigan.
No questions.
No questions.
Redirect.
No questions.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. Mr. Williams. At page 14 of your direct testimony, you described the recent common stock dividend and the plans for future dividend payments. And I just wanted your sense, let me let you turn there. I wanted your sense of how much these dividend payments have affected the common equity component of the capital structure.
Well, they've certainly had an impact on it, and the impact of the dividend payment is to reduce the common equity component. So I can't quantify it exactly, but it's, you know, the common equity level we're talking about in this case, I think, is 51.43, and I'm going to just kind of estimate without the impact of the dividends, I would think the common equity component would be 54-55%. You know, these are the dividends during the test period through June of 2015. So it's served to lower the common equity component and then the revenue requirements in this case.
And just your ballpark estimate would be 200 or 300 basis points or something?
I think so. I mean, subject to check. And I'm trying to be helpful, but I don't have the exact number.
Thank you. Then a question or two about the S&P adjustments for purchase power agreements. Yep. And other items that you discuss on page 19. The PPAs account for about $229 million of $843 million in adjustments. And I just would like any general information about the other
sure
components of the adjustment, if you have them.
Okay. I would say there's probably three or four big other items. I think the biggest other one is the underfunded pension and health care benefits. When S&P and other analysts look at our financial statements, they see the present value of the liabilities of the pension plan and the post-retirement health care plan, and they compare those liabilities to the assets that are in the trust to fund those. And I think when S&P did that, it was underfunded by several $100 million, primarily in the in the post-retirement health care trust. The pension's pretty well funded now. The other items that are in there, accrued interest, which isn't yet payable, and that would be interest on our long-term debt and other securities. That's about $100 million. There's also an adjustment for operating leases. These are not leases that show up as debt on the balance sheet, but just more normal operating leases. The other significant adjustment they make is for asset retirement obligations, which would be essentially decommissioning and restoring plant sites at the end of the plant's life. and that was, I think, in the order of $60 to $80 million. So those are kind of the bigger items that they make adjustments for. And the different agencies will do similar or different adjustments. They're all a little bit unique in how they do that. But they generally kind of follow the same thought process. They might have different treatment of PPAs or pensions or things like that, but it's the general same theory.
So Moody's, for example, do they make similar adjustments for similar categories of interest obligations?
They do for certain of them. Now, Moody's is not as rigid on their PPA adjustments. I think Moody's has the view that if you're recovering the PPAs in rates, customer rates, they will not make the adjustment. Moody's does make the adjustments, though, for the pensions, the post-retirement welfare plans, the leases, and I believe the AROs, asset retirement obligations as well. So there's some consistency between them. There's not a perfect overlap, but there are some similarities on those items.
And forgive me if you mentioned this in your previous answer, but can you roughly quantify the unfunded pension liability component?
The pension is pretty well funded. I don't think that's a significant amount. It's mostly the health care liability.
And thank you.
It's the order of magnitude of several hundred million dollars.
Those are all my questions. Any additional redirect, Mr.
I do have a question based on those questions. Mr. Williams, are you aware of whether the adjustments that are made to Pacific Corps balance sheet by the rating agencies, how they compare in size or, I guess, percentage or scope with those of other electric utilities?
I haven't done a detailed or, a wide comparison of other utilities. I have looked at a few kind of Western utilities, and typically, in my experience, Pacific Corp had more adjustments because of the PPAs than the other utilities do. So based on my, selection and the analysis of those companies, Pacific Corp typically had more adjustments than other utilities.
That's all.
Thank you. You're excused.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll call as our next witness Dr. Samuel Hathaway.
Please raise your right hand, Dr. Hathaway. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Thank you.
Could you please state your full name for the record, Dr. Hathaway?
Samuel C. Hathaway.
And by whom are you employed?
I'm employed by Financo Incorporated in Austin, Texas.
Okay. Did you prepare direct testimony that was filed in this case in January, consisting of the testimony and six exhibits?
Yes, I did.
Do you have any corrections you wish to make to that testimony?
No, sir.
And did you prepare rebuttal testimony filed in this month, May of this year, which also had six exhibits?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections you wish to make to that testimony?
No.
So if I were to ask you the questions set forth in those testimonies today, would your answers then be the same as they're set forth?
Yes.
We would offer Dr. Hathaway's direct and rebuttal testimony with his exhibits.
Any objections?
No.
They're received in evidence.
Dr. Hathaway, do you have a summary of your testimony prepared?
Yes, I have a brief summary.
Could you please present that to the commission?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My testimony addresses the return on equity, or ROE, as we call it. In my direct and rebuttal testimony, I support an ROE of 10.0%. A 10% ROE for Rocky Mountain Power is appropriate for several reasons. Most important, the interest rate environment has changed significantly since 2012, when the company's existing 9.8% ROE was negotiated with the parties and approved by the commission. Additionally, the commission has more recently found an ROE of 9.85% for Questar, even though Questar is acknowledged to have a lower risk profile than Rocky Mountain Power. While it is true that interest rates have dropped back somewhat since the beginning of 2014, they remain 50 basis points higher than they were in 2012, when the prior case was considered and finally decided. The much lower ROEs recommended by the other parties are based on technical models that I believe are out of sync with current market conditions. Back in the 2012 case, interest rates on the 30-year Treasury bond had been pushed down by the government's monetary policies to the lowest levels that ever have existed on that bond. In July of 2012, the average rate on the 30-year Treasury was only 2.59%. At that time, I testified that risk premium estimates of ROE based on those artificially low bond yields did not make sense. On the other hand, in the 2012 case, the DCF models were producing ROEs at 10% and slightly above. While interest rates have increased and risk premium estimates are now in the 10% range and higher, the DCF models are producing ROEs below 9.5%. It is my testimony in this case that it is the DCF model that is now out of sync. It is simply not logical for long-term interest rates to go up substantially and at the same time the quantitative DCF model results to go down just as substantially. The other party's low ROE estimates are caused by their over-reliance on the DCF and other technical models. Had the other witnesses relied less on their low DCF estimates, some of the risk premium estimates support ROEs at 10% and higher. For example, Mr. Peterson's Ibbotson/Morningstar risk premium model produces an ROE of 10.08%. In fairness, he produces other risk premium estimates that are lower than that, but the Ibbotson data that you have used and other commissions have used show slightly over 10%. Similarly, Mr. Lawton's traditional risk premium model produces an ROE range of 9.75 to 10.01%. Likewise, Mr. Gorman's risk premium result based on projected Treasury bond rates in his own testimony is 10.24%. Had Mr. Gorman further adjusted his risk premium results for the tendency of risk premiums to expand when interest rates are low, his numbers would have been 10.5% or higher. I demonstrate that in my rebuttal testimony. These data show that there is a sound support for an ROE well above the other party's recommendations. Their continuing reliance on the DCF model, even though that model is now out of sync with market conditions, is the cause for their low ROE estimates. A more balanced approach, less tied to the technical models, and with further consideration for economic conditions that are improving and interest rates that, while they have declined somewhat in the past few months, are still higher than they were in 2012, clearly supports the company's requested 10%. Thank you. I'll be glad to try to answer any questions you may have.
So Dr. Hathaway is available for cross.
Ms. Schmidt.
Here we go. Good morning, Dr. Hathaway.
Good morning, Ms. Schmidt.
In general, is the economy better today than it was in 2009?
Yes.
In your testimony, did you say any specific things about the 2013 economy?
I believe that I did. I don't remember exactly, but I usually do.
And if we turn to your testimony, we see that what you said is, sorry. On line 101 is that the U.S. economy is finally on what appears to be a sustainably improving track. Does that
Yes, I'm with you.
Said? Okay. Then also later down there, you say that although unemployment remains a concern, most economists now expect the government's monetary policies to become less accommodative over the coming year. Is that right?
Yes.
And is that still your view?
Absolutely.
Would you say that the financial markets are in less turmoil now than they were in 2013? Sorry, 2009?
Yes.
I have an exhibit that I would like to present, and if we could label this as DPU cross exhibit one. It is a two-sided exhibit, and the title is Financial Market Stress Falls to its Lowest Level in Over 7 Years. If you could take just a quick look at that one. Have you had a chance to quickly take a look at this?
I'm just getting to the back part.
Okay.
Yes, I have.
I will represent that this was downloaded from the stlouisfed.org website on May 22nd and is a true and correct copy of what was there. Sorry, it was on the 27th, and the date of the article is the 22nd. I downloaded on the 27th. Will you look at the top of the page where it says financial market stress falls to its lowest level in over 7 years? And then there is a graph below that. Is that correct?
That's right.
Do you agree with the St. Louis Fed's conclusion that the financial market stress is at its lowest level in 7 years?
With the caveat that we have to look at those other two graphs that are down below there.
Okay.
You notice they're based on the level of the stock market, the S&P 500, and various other kinds of interest rates. So it depends on how you define stress, but certainly the graph sort of speaks for itself in terms of the stock market has come back up to record high levels, interest rates have been low, those kinds of things. If that's the indication of stress that they're talking about here, then those are certainly true facts.
Thank you. And the St. Louis Fed is one organization that you relied upon for some of your numbers, is that correct?
For the data, yes.
I'd like to move for the admission of DPU cross exhibit one.
Any objection?
No objection.
It's received.
In your direct, you talk about significant increases in long-term interest rates from June 19th, 2013 forward. Does that sound familiar? That would be your direct pages 5 and 6?
Yes. I'm sorry. I was looking at page 8 where the table is. That's the easiest place to see how they've changed.
I'll reference table 8 then, too. So you still believe that there will be significant increases?
The next table that we come to is a forward curve, so-called Bloomberg curves, and yes, they still indicate that interest rates will go up, not from where they were in December or November of 2013, but from where they are now.
federal government has had what it's called a quantitative easing program for quite some time. Have the feds announced that they will change what they are doing under that program, and if so, when?
Yes, they started back earlier in, they announced it June of 2013, and then they delayed the so-called tapering of their asset purchases. But they have now had at least four announcements of where they have reduced those purchases and have said they can plan to stop those purchases altogether by the end of 2014.
Has the federal government also announced an intention to raise its interest rates right away in conjunction with its changes to the quantitative easing program?
Well, not the short-term interest rates. They're tying that more to the level of unemployment and with the new chairman, Ms. Yellen, the look at the unemployment rate has become more of a focus maybe than the inflation rate. And so they're saying that short-term rates may be a while out before they reduce those or increase those, but they have acknowledged that they're going to do that. But the quantitative easing program is more the long-term treasury bond rates that we talk about in the cost of equity.
In conjunction with that, I'd like to pass out something that I'd like to label as DPU Cross Exhibit 2. And it also is a two-sided exhibit, and the top is entitled Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. Have you had a chance to take just a quick look at this?
Yes, I've read it before.
Is it correct that this press release, dated April 30th, 2014, says that economic conditions, and I'll read the whole sentence, the committee currently anticipates that even after employment and inflation are at near mandate consistent levels, economic conditions may, for some time, warrant keeping the target federal funds rate below levels the committee views as normal in the long run?
Yes, again, that's the short-term rate.
And next, I'd like to talk just a little bit about ROE trends. Oh, yes.
Are you finished with the cross exhibit two?
Thank you, and I would request that it be admitted.
And just for the record, the copy that I have really has nothing of substance on the back. There's just a header. Is that true?
That is correct.
Okay.
The only thing of substance on the back page is that it says the last update was April 30th, 2014.
Right.
May that be admitted?
Any objection? It's received.
Next, I'd like to talk just a little bit about ROE trends. In your testimony, in your testimony today, you say that the regulated ROE returns are in the 10% range and higher. Did I hear that correctly?
No, I think in my summary I said that the risk premium models indicate that. I have an exhibit that shows in my rebuttal testimony, it's Exhibit SCH-2R, that shows exactly what the trends and the allowed rates of return have been.
And I have something I'd like you to take just a quick look at here. And I'd like this marked as PPU Cross Exhibit 3, please. It is a multi-page document. And on the first page, left-hand margin, it says rate case history, past rate cases. And then there's a list of companies with their ROEs and other statistics of financial interest listed across a table of each sheet. Have you had a chance just to take a brief look at this?
Yes, I've seen this before too.
That makes my job easier, thank you. When we turn to the last page, which talks about the year 2012, and it's the last page of a three-page exhibit, single-sided. For 2012, the average to date was 1017, is that correct? Return on equity, 10.17?
Yes, I was just looking at the dates. They're okay. Upside down. They go from January at the bottom up to December. But that's, yes, the full year for 2012, the average for all the cases was 10.17.
Are you familiar with what Virginia Rider decisions are?
Yes.
Could you give just a brief two or three sentence explanation of how, of what they are and how perhaps they affect return on equity?
Right, and I exclude those in my Exhibit 2R just for the purpose of what you're asking. But in Virginia, they have had commission orders that for the past several years on pre-approved power plant construction situations that they have adders, and they have riders and rates that automatically adjust the ROE upward, I think by maybe as much as 100 or 150 basis points. So RRA and I and most regulatory economists take those cases out of the averages when we're talking about that. And back in my Exhibit 2R, I certainly do that. I must say that we also take out the distribution-only companies, which is not done in this exhibit.
So on the 2012 page, the return on equity that I would like to focus on is 10.05?
I believe it's 06. 10.06. That's the one where those power plant cases are taken out from Virginia.
Thank you. Then if we turn to the middle sheet of our three-page exhibit, we see that that is for 2013. Is that correct?
That's right.
And what does it say that the average for 2013 is without the Virginia Rider decisions?
9.84. And again, Norman Schmidt, that it does include the T&D only cases that are about 40 basis points. The T&D, transmission and distribution only cases, that are about 40 basis points lower than the average.
And I'll get to that in just a minute. Then on the first page, it talks about the average ROE 2014 to date. Is that correct?
That's right.
And the average there is 9.62. Is that correct?
That's right.
In your exhibits, you have an exhibit that contains, actually, okay, no, I'll leave that there. Moving on to some more cost of equity issues. If we can look at your testimony, and what I've done is I've had excerpts from your testimony copied. But before actually we do that, I'd like to request the admission of DPU Cross Exhibit 3.
Any objections? Received.
What I'm passing out now, I'd like to mark for identification as DPU Cross Exhibit 4. And what this is it is several excerpts from Dr. Hadaway's testimony in Utah over the years. And it starts with excerpts of your testimony from 2013. Is that right?
I think you missed me.
Oh! My apologies.
Thank you. That's all right.
And I will represent that these are true and accurate copies of your testimonies, but you may wish to use the printed testimonies in your book. They should be exactly the same. So in this case, in your direct, is it true that you recommended an ROE of 10%?
Yes, that's right.
And when I look at something that is not in here, when I look at table 4 in your direct at pages 28 and 29, which model produces the highest result out of the models that you have listed there?
On page 29 in table 4?
Yes.
The equity risk premium ROE model.
And that is a 10.1%, is that correct?
Yes.
And if we look at your indicated DCF range in your direct, it's 9.1 to 9.7?
That's right.
You also say some things in your direct that I would like to discuss. If we turn to your direct at lines 438, which are not in our packet either, I apologize. So that's on about page 20 of your direct and continues on to page 21. Is that correct?
I'm sorry. I may have missed the first part of your question.
Okay. I'm just trying to get you to a certain place in your testimony right,
right.
now.
Right. I'm on page 20 right now.
Perfect. Do you state that a combination of DCF and the basic risk premiums methods usually provide the most reliable approach?
Well, that's the bottom part of that sentence, but the line immediately before it says in periods of reasonable capital market equilibrium that that's been the case.
And then do you also say that the combination and based risk premium methods usually provide should be discounted because of the low ROE results? More or less, paraphrasing.
I'm sorry, Ms. Schmidt, could you tell me the lines you're looking at?
I'm looking at 447 through 449. So you want to discount the low ROE estimates from both the risk premium and the DCF models. Is that correct?
And again, I say because of government's monetary policy in the previous line to that. That's explaining why I think they're not as reliable right now as they've been in the past.
Then when we switch to your rebuttal, what is your recommended range of your risk premium results?
The updated risk premium?
Uh-huh.
It's 9.7 to 9.8.
But your recommendation is at 10?
Yes, as I've explained in my rebuttal, my risk premium in my original testimony, the other party's risk premium results in their own testimony show returns well above 10%, as I explained that in my summary a few minutes ago.
Now turning to your testimony in the docket 11035-200 case. And the excerpts from this testimony are in your packet. The excerpts I'm going to reference.
We're looking at cross-examination exhibit 4.
Yes. Or actually, why don't we make could we make this cross exhibit 5 just for reference?
And what would be 4 then?
No, this would be 4 would be the 2013 packet, which we don't have. So this would be 4. This would be 4. And that's the 2012 excerpts. Okay, if we look at your table on page 31, what type or what methods produce the highest range? Your DCF or your equity premium?
The DCF model did.
And here you recommend the cost of equity at the highest of your DCF range. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I'm going to read a statement, and then I'm going to ask you if you have comments on it. If we turn to your direct at page 31, the direct for the docket, the 11 docket, 11035-200. So I'm at lines 627 through 629. And I'll just read this and then I have some questions.
Ms. Schmidt, just so I'm clear, so you're in the subset of DPU cross-examination exhibit 4 that has the handwritten date 2-15-2012.
Yes, and I think it might be easier if we make this one 4 and then the 10 docket 5 and then the 9 docket 6, just so I can keep track. So if we're looking at what's been pre-marked as cross exhibit 4 for the DPU, and we're now looking at lines 627 through 629. And there you say, and I'll paraphrase, that the requested ROE, the ROE that you recommend, which is at the top of your DCF range, is appropriate given the turmoil in the markets. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, the sentence is there if everybody's at the same place here, and it speaks for itself. It says the fair and reasonable ROE for RMP is 10.2%. The requested ROE at the top of my DCF range is appropriate given the ongoing effects of U.S. and global economic turmoil and the equity market for utility shares. And I explained both of those in a lot more detail earlier in this testimony.
In your rebuttal, you change companies, and then you have a DCF range of, sorry, you change methods. And you now have a DCF of 9.6 to 10.2.
No, I don't think that's right.
I'm going to object. That's very vague. I'm not sure what rebuttal we're talking about or where we are.
Okay. So. Schmidt, I think it would be helpful if you could rephrase your question.
I think that you're right. If we turn to the end of the packet that we've marked cross exhibit 4, the last two pages are from his rebuttal testimony in that docket.
Okay, so we're still within the 2-15-2012?
Yes, and that's the date on the front of the packet.
Case. Thank you.
What?
I'm sorry, Ms. Schmidt. I'm not with you. I'm trying, but
okay. So if we take our packet, it has the 2-15-2002.
Okay.
We turn to the last page.
2012, right?
2012, thank you. And then we flip to the front side of that last page.
Okay, I'm with you now.
Here, you continue to use the DCF analysis, which gave you the highest result. Is that correct in your recommendation? Higher than the risk premium models?
Back in that table 5, it did. This seems to be talking about maybe my rebuttal update. I don't see a table for that. 10.2 was certainly the highest in the direct testimony. I don't recall, as I sit here, just what the total analysis showed in the update.
I believe that you, on the last page of that exhibit, you say that the company's initial rate of 10.2% remains reasonable.
On the last, very back, yes, I do.
And so that's using the DCF model. Turning to our third group of, or turning to what I'll call the second group in our packet, and we'll mark that DPU cross exhibit 5 for identification.
And which?
It has on the front, it has a date of one, handwritten date of 1-24-2011.
So we'll mark that DPU cross exhibit 5.
Here, you use, here you say, and where I'm on page 32 and 33, which is the second page of your packet, here you say that you discount the bond yield premium results because the interest rates are artificially depressed by the government, monetary policy, and continuing turbulence of the equity capital markets.
That's at the bottom of page 32, yeah. Where you're reading? Yes.
And here, you use your highest number as a DCF range, is that right? And or your highest numbers are derived from your DCF models, and that range is 10.1 to 10.7.
There are a lot of different cases, but we didn't ask for 10-7 in that case,
right,
if that's
right,
what,
right.
Just so we're clear on that.
And here, you discounted the bond yield premium results. Is that right?
Yes, and if you go ahead with the sentence that you started to read, it says, because interest rates on high-quality debt are currently artificially depressed by the government's monetary policy, which I had, again, discussed in detail earlier in this testimony.
In your, if we turn to the next page, it is, it starts an excerpt on your rebuttal testimony in that docket.
Are you saying that these pages are from the rebuttal?
Yes.
I'm having trouble telling. Okay. If that's where they're from, that's fine.
On the bottom of the page, there's a footer which says rebuttal or direct.
Right. And mine says direct.
Okay. Keep going. I'll give you mine.
Okay. No, I'm sorry. I had it folded. Okay. I'm with you now.
Okay. Here, instead of disparaging the risk premium results, you adopted the risk premium results in contrast to what you did in your direct. Is that correct?
In the docket 10-35-125. So when you say here, you're talking about?
It's 10-035-124.
Okay. And I'm sorry, you're saying that I, in my rebuttal testimony,
your equity risk premium numbers were higher than your DCF numbers. Is that correct in your rebuttal?
Yes, so back on page 35, there at lines 723 through 726, that shows what you just said to be true, but we did not reject the DCF numbers or switch to the risk premium numbers. We stayed at the 10.5.
But that's also within the range of the risk premium, right?
And the DCF.
Okay. Also in this section of your testimony, you state that interest forecasts for the coming year indicate significant further rate increases.
Could you give us a line number?
I'll give you,
We're still in cross-exhibit five?
Still in cross-exhibit five. Lines 733 and 734.
And that's the rebuttal?
Of the rebuttal, uh-huh.
Thank you.
Do you know if the expected or anticipated further interest rate increases occurred and if they were significant?
They did not occur. The Federal Reserve System pressed its quantitative easing policies during the period that followed this, and they pushed interest rates down further.
Hello? Is someone on the line that needs to be recognized or has a question? Oh. We assume not, then.
And then turning to the last set in your packet, which is for the 2009 case. And on the front page of this packet, which I'd like to label DPU Cross Exhibit 6 for identification, there is a page from the Commission's docket index that lists the docket number and then lists some documents that were filed in this docket. Are we there?
I believe so.
So this is 09035-23?
Yes.
Okay. And then just for clarification, the excerpts from Dr. Hadaway's testimony in this proceeding are those going to be used, or are they no longer part of the cross-examination exhibits?
Let's eliminate them from the cross-examination exhibits and use the testimony that we referenced in his book and in our books that was filed for reference. I apologize for having the wrong pages in the first one. Okay. In docket number 090523, which did you use both the DCF model and the risk premium model? And is that depicted in your chart, your table number 4 on page 35?
I haven't read this in a long time, but certainly both models support the requested 11%, yes.
Your DCF model there, the constant growth, analyst growth, produced the highest result of a range ending in 12?
Well, they're higher than the risk premium results, but we didn't even ask for a number as high as any of those numbers that you're pointing to.
So you asked for the 11 there. And here, did you say that the risk premium methods and the DCF methods I'll skip that. You had some interesting things to say about the DCF results in this case. And if we turn to page 35 and we look at lines 748 through 753, you talk about increased market volatility and investor risk. And then is it true that you say that both the DCF and the risk premium models, and I'll use my word, are useful in this analysis?
No, I say they're very conservative estimates. Ms. Schmidt, this case, and I'm glad you brought it up, because this shows exactly what's wrong with what's going on in the present case. We don't rely strictly on these quantitative models. This commission never has, and it should not in the present case. Currently, DCF numbers are off the chart low. Here they were a bit on the high side. We didn't use them, and the commission didn't use them, and that's what this shows.
But in the cases that we've discussed here today, hasn't your recommended range been within the range of your DCF and risk premium model results, except for in today's case where you're requesting a rate that is higher?
Absolutely not. Look at table 4 right there on page 35 of the 09 case. The 11% is below any number in the DCF results up there in that box. They're only, the 11% There's only one number down in risk premium at 1077 that's lower than what we asked for. We don't mechanically apply these models. We always have to use judgment and review what's going on in the economy and review what's going on and not mechanically try to say, here's the lowest number or the highest number we can present.
Okay. I'll move on. You talked about the Questar rate case in your testimony and in your summary. And is it your opinion here today that the Questar gas decision supports your recommended 10% ROE in this case?
It depends on how you look at the risk nature of the company. But you have, in your own testimony, stated that Questar is less risky than Rocky Mountain Power. And depending on what sort of a spread you would put there, then the 1085 certainly, the 985 would certainly support 10.
Is Questar Gas one of your proxy companies?
No.
Why not?
It's a gas company.
And gas companies are different than electric companies?
They are. They're less risky, generally.
They're less risky. In the Questar case, the commission dropped the awarded ROE by 0.5 basis points. By 50 basis points. If we use that drop here, do we get to a 9.5?
We were never at 1035 like Questar was. So I don't know. You can subtract 50 basis points from any number you want to and come up with a different number, but it doesn't have anything to do with what Rocky Mountain Power's cost of equity is.
But you said that gas and electric companies are different.
Gas companies are generally viewed as less risky.
And so you're saying, actually, I'm not going to ask that question. And then I believe that someone else probably have questions on the Washington case. Does someone else have questions on the Washington? I'll let them address those. It's all my questions. Thank you.
Oh, I would like to move for the admission of DPU 4, 5, and 6, however.
Any objections? They're received. Mr. Coleman.
Dr. Hadaway, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Coleman.
My name is Brent Coleman. I am counsel for the Office of Consumer Services. This is the first time we've had the opportunity to meet, so greetings. And I have a number of subject matters to talk to you about, hopefully relatively quickly. I don't mean to make promises perhaps I can't keep, but I'll do my best. You do have a copy of your direct and rebuttal testimonies with you in front of you?
Yes.
I'm going to ask you to turn, first I'd like to turn in your direct testimony, in this case, to line 103.
Mr. Coleman, for your planning purposes, we're going to take a break at 10:30. We'll have a 10-minute break.
Okay.
Will that be adequate given the stairs or the elevators and other issues? Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. So line 103, we're direct.
Yes, I'm there.
Okay, so just this first part, just trying to make maybe some discussion about maybe some language corrections or clarifications, just to be clear for what I understand. I'm going to go ahead and read the sentence that you have from your testimony that begins on line 103. If you go ahead and correct me if I mistake, if I insert something that's not there, omit something that's there. Beginning again, line 103, the sentence reads, quote, "The stock market has largely recovered from its losses during the financial crisis, and consumer confidence is improving," period, end quote. Did I read that correctly?
Yes.
And this testimony was submitted to the commission early January of this year, I presume probably prepared by you sometime during December of 2013 in drafting for drafting purposes.
That's about right.
Would you agree with me that since the preparation and presentation of your testimony, that multiple stock indices have closed at near or at record highs?
Some of them have.
Would you agree with me that just this week the S&P 500 closed at a record high?
Yeah, it came down yesterday, but yes, the 2 days before, it was at a record high.
2 days ago, it was a record high. And would you agree with me that the S&P closing of 2 days ago was the 12th record high closing of this calendar year?
I read that in the paper this morning, yes.
You would agree that's a correct?
That's correct.
So would you, in the beginning of your testimony, you had no corrections. Would you still continue to characterize those record high and near record high closings as largely recovered, or would you consider the stock market to be fully recovered and stronger?
The S&P, which is the broadest market in that, well, it's not the broadest, but it's probably the most representative of the overall market, has certainly fully recovered and then some. But some of the small cap stocks and others that were pushed down more have not quite recovered. So that's all I had in mind by largely.
The Dow has also, the Dow Jones Industrial has also closed.
Yeah, but those are even larger companies, only 30 of the very largest. And all I meant by largely there was simply that there are some segments of the small cap and some tech areas that simply haven't recovered from where they went down to.
And then just below there, begins, I guess, well, the very next sentence, line 104 through 106. And again, some of these subject matters may overlap with Ms. Schmidt, but I guess I might need a slightly different point. So I apologize for perhaps sounding a bit redundant. Line, I'll go ahead and read again. Correct me if I misstate. Quote, although unemployment remains a concern, most economists now expect the government's monetary policies to become less accommodative over the coming year, period, end quote. Did I get that correct?
Yes.
And then you have line 143 beginning there, and I'll continue to read again. Correct me if I'm wrong. Quote, this slightly changed stance from the FOMC has led investors... It's the two investors' expectations for less accommodative monetary policy, which in turn have led to significant increases in long-term interest rates, period, end quote. Did I read that correctly?
Yes.
And then you have a similar reference on line 156 of your testimony, direct testimony in this case, and it reads, quote, as noted above in its June 19, 2013 press release, the FOMC indicated that improving economic conditions might lead to tapering off of its stimulus programs, period, end quote. Did I read that correctly?
Yes.
And in conjunction with that testimony, you have a block quote. It begins on page 5, line 107 or 109 of your direct testimony. Spills over to page 6, and that is from the FOMC press release of June 19th, 2013.
Right.
Correct. And you represent that is the source for your concern of the less accommodative monetary policies presented by the Fed.
Well, there was also a press release, and then Chairman Bernanke did a video presentation. There was, you know, there were a whole lot of things that went on that same meeting of the FOMC. But this is what their official release was that they put on the Fed's website,
okay,
a portion of it.
But since that testimony, since the presentation of this testimony and the quotation of this June 19 press release, the Fed has announced the continuation of those highly accommodative policies, correct?
Right. And in the piece that Ms. Schmidt put up here, and I believe it's one of her exhibits, that's from the most recent meeting in April of this year. And if you look at them, they say the same thing, with slight tweaks to the words here and there.
Sure, correct. And actually, you cite in a footnote on page 6 that the concern that you outlined from the June press release didn't actually come to pass. In your footnote 1 on page 6, you cite the October 2013 notes, and your testimony, the footnote reads, quote, while the FOMC as of its most recent meeting, October 29-October 30, 2013, has not reduced its treasury bond or mortgage-backed securities purchases. And then the statement goes on, its statements following each meeting have continued to indicate likely tapering of accommodative monetary policy as economic and particularly labor markets conditions improve over the coming year, period, end quote. That's the footnote?
That's the footnote at that time, but they certainly have, as it showed in the more recent FOMC announcement, they certainly have started the tapering. They've reduced their bond purchases by about half and have continued to say they're going by the end of the year to have entirely eliminated those bond purchases.
But when you presented this testimony and cited the June comments, the footnote indicates that you understood that the reduction of those accommodative policies hadn't actually occurred.
By November, when we were preparing this testimony, they hadn't, but they have now.
Okay.
And that's discussed in the rebuttal testimony.
So let me turn your attention back to Ms. Schmidt's DPU cross exam exhibit number 2.
I have it.
So let's see. In the text, it appears to be the third paragraph from the bottom, paragraph one being the paragraph that reads voting for FOMC monetary policy. So if you go up to the paragraph that begins to support continuing progress, you have that one. So
yes.
I'm going to go ahead and read the last sentence of that paragraph. Again, correct me if I misstate. The press release reads, quote, "The committee continues to anticipate, based on its assessment of these factors, that it likely will be appropriate to maintain the current target range for the federal funds rate for a considerable time after the asset purchase program ends, especially if projected inflation continues to run below the committee's 2% longer-run goal and provided that longer-term inflation expectations remain well-anchored," period, end quote. Did I read that correctly?
You read that correctly, but the relevant paragraph is a bit above that.
The one you're asking me about
is what I explained to Ms. Schmidt and also said, I believe, in one of the other questions, is about short-term interest rates. Up at the paragraph that begins with the committee judges there is sufficient underlying strength in the broader economy, they explain that they have done what they've done with their asset purchase program and that they intend over the year to complete that program and cease that effect on long-term interest rates. So you're talking about two different things.
But the larger accommodative monetary policies will continue for a considerable amount of time.
The short-term interest rate policy of maintaining the federal funds rate, which is an overnight rate that banks pay to borrow reserves, is intended to stay low until they're satisfied that unemployment is at a low enough level.
Did you provide testimony to the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission in docket UE130043?
I'll accept that docket number, but yes, in Pacific Corp's most recent case there.
January of 2013.
That sounds about right.
If I may.
Please.
I have an excerpt of testimony from your direct, and I have a full copy if you'd like to confirm that it's accurate. In the interest of resources, I just tried to have a couple of.
I
for purposes of identification, if we could mark this as OCS cross number one. Do you recognize this testimony?
Yes.
And this was, in fact, the testimony that you provided to the Washington Commission in January of 2013?
Yes.
If you would turn to the part of your exhibit that contains pages 5 and 6. Now I've got to find my notes. Apologies.
It's a good time for a break.
Sure. Perfect.
We'll be in recess until 20 minutes to 11. Off the record. If you have an additional